back in session. On NRA receivership of Southwest Exchange, Inc. et al. This is 57846. As was indicated earlier, we have three justices who are not participating, Justice Pickering, Chief Judge Cherry, and Justice Seda. Justice Perry has reviewed the material, but he will review the oral arguments at this date before a decision is reached, and he is participating in this. With that, if the parties are ready, please proceed. And if you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Attorney Michael R. Pontoni, bar number 4030, on behalf of the appellant P.J. DeMarnay. At issue before the court is our appeal to this court to reverse the summary judgment granted to the plaintiffs in this case, and also affirmatively direct the lower court to enter summary judgment in favor of P.J. DeMarnay, my client. The heart of the issue goes to a simple question of contract interpretation. The lower court found that the releases at issue, one from Citibank and one from UBS, were narrow in their application to the particular case. In particular, that court found that the releases did not cover conduct outside the scope of employment. We think this court, upon reviewing that, both of those releases will find otherwise. And once it does so, then the case boils down to whether there is substantial evidence in the record to support the court's finding that my client engaged in misconduct after he left UBS. My client, of course, is an investment advisor. At issue were funds that he had handled while employed at Citibank and UBS. The respondents and the plaintiffs below hang their hat on essentially three pieces of so-called evidence to prove misconduct after PJ left UBS. It consists of the master complaint. It consists of what's called the Keys memo, and then the third piece of evidence, so-called evidence, is my client's refusal to answer questions during his deposition based upon his assertion of his Fifth Amendment rights. We cite the Foster versus Dingwall case for the proposition that a complaint in and of itself is not evidence. With regard to the so-called Keys memo, we point out that the document itself doesn't identify who the author is. It's not signed. It's not dated. It doesn't say in the text of the document who the author is. It doesn't have a signature line indicating who the author is. It does not in any way identify itself as being authored by any particular person. This document was not supported by any other evidence, i.e. an affidavit, anything of that nature. I posited in my brief that I wasn't certain as to whether Mr. Keys had even given a deposition in the case, and the fact of the matter is that he had. It's in fact included in the papers addenda provided by the respondents. And having reviewed that excerpt, it's clear that there is no question posed to Mr. Keys with regard to any event occurring after July of 2004. My client didn't leave UBS until February of 2005. There's no reference to the so-called Keys memo. The document's not admissible under NRCP 56. It's not evidence. The third matter goes to the inferences, negative inferences taken from my client taking the Fifth Amendment, asserting his Fifth Amendment right not to answer deposition questions. We rely on the Francis versus Wynn case from this court, where this court took essentially the high road insofar as the right of a litigant to assert that privilege. with appropriate limitations, all of which were satisfied by my client. He never made an affirmative representation at any time during this case. He never provided an affidavit, not even in response to a summary judgment motion. So there cannot be any adverse inferences taken from the myriad questions that were posed to him. Respondents also suggest that the Keyes memo and the deposition questions taken together, wherein PJ is referred to as the treasurer of this company, Credit Reef, is dispositive or helpful to the case for them. And we point out that not only was PJ not the treasurer of the company, and it's not clear whether they want to impute him with alleged misconduct of Capital Reef or, I think I misspoke and said Credit Reef, but Capital Reef, or what the import of that is, although they mentioned it about 20 times. But there's no evidence in the record, none, not an affidavit, not a deposition transcript, nothing to imply, let alone express, that PJ served as an officer, director, shareholder, or other person on behalf of Capital Reef. So throughout the pleadings below and the pleadings up here, it's, you know, he's constantly referred to as a treasurer for this company.
Could you turn your attention to the settlement agreements or purported settlement agreements?
Yes.
And what they held from your standpoint?
Well, the settlement agreements, Your Honor, were perfectly clear. And what they did is, in each instance, they carved out, they released everybody from liability for everything since the beginning of time, with the exception of PJ. They carved out his release of liability based upon time, not based upon conduct, not based upon status, based upon time. And that time reference had to do with his period of employment. So both of those releases, the city release and the UBS release, expressly reference the time he was employed. Judge Gonzalez below found that the release did not reach his conduct within that time, but outside the scope of his employment. And without belaboring the point, we respectfully submit that it just is an inappropriate reading of the release. It clearly doesn't have that limitation. It didn't say released with regard to his work, his employment, or anything like that, without adding his time during those periods of employment. It's just, it can't be any clearer. It's undisputed that my client worked for UBS until February of 2005. We point out that, again, there's no evidence to support the contention that he engaged in any wrongful conduct after that time. There's also no proof, let alone allegation, of causation of anything my client did that caused damages after that time.
It's what about, Mr. Pontine, maybe in the order that Judge Gonzalez said, in the order of judgment, and under there's about five categories of different plaintiffs where judgments are awarded.
Yes.
I notice in one of them it says interest from January 31, 2007, you know, which would have been after the release. What we're curious was, when were these monies taken or whatever to in reference to his employment with Citi? And that January 31st date, I don't know where that came from as far as the accrual of interest. And
sure. What happened was, in 2004, the stock of Southwest Exchange was sold to Capital Reef. That transaction closed on, I believe it was June 30.
That's 04, June 30.
04.
Okay.
And that's when PJ gets the ride on the jet airplane to Acapulco or something like that, and they make a point of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the control of the company occurred at that time while PJ was at Citi. Now, once McGann took control of Southwest, the great majority of Southwest's cash assets were transferred. They were transferred to They were loaned to Blackstone. Blackstone then went to another intermediary, and the monies were then invested. The act of taking control of the monies occurred, in June of 2004. Most of the monies are transferred out at that time. PJ then leaves Citi in August of 2004 and goes to UBS. He takes that account with him, along with many other accounts that he was handling at Citi, and he goes to UBS. He stays at UBS until February of 2005. Now, during that time, McGann is continuing to use the funds, what formerly Southwest funds, now Capital Reef funds, to loan monies to basically as his own piggy bank to do his investments and what have you. And so all we know, though, is that according to the master complaint and the evidence submitted in support of that on motion for summary judgment, is exactly what happened or what the machinations were prior, really, to the money and the account leaving Citi. There really are no representations, no deposition transcripts, no affidavits, no anything, or even claims that assert that misconduct that PJ was near or could have been involved with occurred after that August 2004 date. So he ends up at UBS until February of 2005. Then he leaves UBS and he's solely at Capital Reef. Our point is this, that on a fraud allegation or RICO, both require clear and convincing evidence. It has to be properly pled. Causation has to be shown. They needed to, both at the outset of the case and in moving for summary judgment, show or at least allege state conduct by PJ. What did he do? And what was the result of that? And they failed to do that. They did a pretty good job of doing those kinds of things for the city period of time and the deposition transcripts and all those. And it's highly, and essentially in their motion for summary judgment, they do a good job of that, and they essentially stop their factual pattern and their explanation of facts at PJ leaving Citi with a quip to the effect, and then PJ went to UBS.
Well, counsel, I'm assuming that the findings made by the judge in the summary judgment, primarily beginning on page 17, are taken from the complaint. Is that right?
Well, they were prepared, of course, by plaintiff's counsel.
Right.
And they appear to have been, cut and pasted in great deal from the complaint.
Right.
But as we know from Foster versus Dingwall.
Before we get to, I understand your argument that these allegations aren't supported by anything admissible in connection with the MSJ.
Yes.
I'm just trying to clarify where these came from. It appears as though these findings by the judge came from the complaint.
Well, I would say no. They go well beyond that. If you compare those findings to the complaint, I mean, there were liberties were taken ad nauseum.
Okay, was the complaint verified?
No.
Okay. And on the point, on this point, though, if I look at finding 144 and going forward, it appears as though there are a number of findings in which the diversion of Southwest money, the loss that Southwest primarily sustained, occurs after the finding at 144. PJ immediately left his employment with Smith Barney to become financial consultant for Southwest Exchange at UBS.
Yes. Here's how we see that. Of course, when he left Citi or Smith Barney and goes to UBS, he's still covered by the releases. It's really his post-UBS conduct. But what the court is saying is correct. There are averments, even in the master complaint, to the effect that the shoe continued to drop or the losses continued until the thing completely closed down in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And our point is this, that accepting that as true, we still have to deal with paragraph 44 of the master complaint. In that paragraph 44, they say exactly that, but they say the causation occurred while PJ was at Citi and at UBS and acting within the scope of his employment there, and that he knew that that was going to happen. And it was a natural and foreseeable result, and essentially that in their complaint, they say the causation occurred back then. Number two, they, assuming there's a continuum of losses, and we pointed out that the great deal of the losses occurred right when the closing of the deal on June 30th when Southwest was sold, the court never makes a distinction or tries to find out, well, what losses occurred prior to February of 2005 before when the release cuts off, and what damages were caused by conduct afterward.
One additional question, if I may, Justice Douglas. I was a bit confused about the inclusion of UBS within the release. The release itself only refers to Citigroup. Is that the same as UBS? Are they one and the same?
There are two releases.
Oh.
One release was obtained
out of federal court.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Okay. So, yeah, the one, and well, it's noteworthy because UBS isn't even a defendant, a defendant in the state court case. There was a parallel federal case. That release came out of that federal case, District of Nevada, and there's never been a representation allegation from any of the plaintiffs to the effect that release was not effective in the state court proceeding or anything of that nature.
Well, did the judge consider that in the summary judgment order?
She found that with regard to both releases, both the Citi and the UBS release, that they were valid, but they were limited in scope, and that limitation concerned PJ's conduct while employed and within the scope of his employment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used up all your time. We'll give you an additional 2 minutes. We'll add 2 minutes to counsel's time.
Associate Chief Justice, Justices, my name is Mark Cook. I'm from the law firm of Bayless, Cook & Colasis. I represent the respondents, which is an accumulation of exchangers. I think it's important to give some brief factual background to put this in some context. P.J. DeMarnay worked at Citibank when this Ponzi scheme began. And what happened is he had a client who owned a 1031 exchange company. What that company does is for the benefit of 1031 exchange, if I'm buying a piece or selling a piece of property and want to do a 1031 exchange, the money from my sale goes into the company. Under the IRS code, they've got to hold the money. It has to be my money that closes my new purchase for me to get that tax-deferred benefit. So what happens with Southwest Exchange, especially in the context of time we're talking about, 2004 with the real estate market in Nevada, is there is a lot of money in trust being held, and then when it closes, my money is used to close my sale. Mr. DeMarnay also represents Don McGahn, who he knows is looking to invest in a number of other outside interests, and Mr. DeMarnay, from representing Southwest Exchange, also knows that the owner of that is looking to sell it. So what happens is he approaches McGahn and says, this company's got a lot of cash on hand. And by the way, he knows it's a 1031 exchange company, has a lot of cash on hand, facilitates the purchase, because what McGahn is going to do upon purchase is through a company called Blackstone, not the Blackstone we all know, but a separately created shell company called Blackstone. The money is going to go into there, then offshore to France for a silicone implant company. But he's not getting enough from the sale, so Mr. DeMarnay is also soliciting from private investors to come up with money to do this. Ultimately, McGahn buys Southwest Exchange. Mr. DeMarnay gets the flight to the Bahamas, Council mentioned, $200,000 in cash to his wife. And now the Ponzi scheme has started, because now instead of closing my sale with my money, my sale is closing with the next buyer. They're out of trust. They're immediately out of trust over $30 million. This is continuing. Dean Larnay gets terminated by Citibank, who were doing an investigation of this problem at the time, and he goes to UBS. When he goes to UBS, he brings the McGann account. Counsel said he brought other accounts, too. I don't believe that's in the record at all. It was never an issue. But he does bring McGann's accounts. He knows it's out-of-trust money. He continues the Ponzi scheme while at UBS. He then moves, as counsel stated, to Capital Reef. Capital Reef is the majority shareholder of Southwest Exchange. He is the treasurer of Capital Reef. As the treasurer of Capital Reef, the Keys memo, which was attached to the summary judgment paperwork and which was not objected to, as we heard Ms. Pickering's question in the early argument on the summary judgment, wasn't objected to as evidence at that time. But what happens is he's running what Mr. Keys called the deep-in-the-money covered call strategy. What he's doing is he's continuing the Ponzi scheme. That's from winter of 2005 forward. Our clients put our money in 2006, 2007. It's late January of 2007 when Southwest Exchange closes.
You have and Mr. DeMarnay left Citi in 2005?
He left Citi in four, UBS in 2005.
So you're saying your clients' money came in afterwards?
All of our money. There was $97 million lost.
Mm-hmm.
The state court defendants represent $56 million approximately of that. And by the way, UBS was a defendant in the state court action as well. What happened is they settled early, so the Fourth Amendment complaint does not include UBS because they were.
And Mr. Cook, maybe I can get this straight because we're trying to get these dates down because I think they're important here. So for the time period that Mr. DeMarnay worked at Citi, and UBS, none of this money, which was the subject of this lawsuit, none of that money was converted. It came in afterwards, then.
Correct. And I went through all that history in the motion work because it sets up his knowledge of the Ponzi scheme. And now while at Capital Reef, our money goes in. And when our money goes in, when I sell my property, and it wasn't my property, but by way of example, I sell my property summer 2006. My money goes in. It's supposed to sit there. What it does instead is it closes somebody else's sale because that money went offshore and by the way, went away.
I think we get all that. I think the key issue the court's concerned, I don't mean to speak for my colleagues, but I believe it's the focus of the releases. Are they valid, number one? Did Judge Gonzalez rule correctly on their inapplicability? And even if they are valid, does it matter because of the timing of this is when the money went in? So maybe you could address those issues then.
Absolutely. And for me, the release is really an academic issue. It's not necessary for us to prevail because we have three separate time frames of culpability for Mr. DeMarnay. The first one, when he set it up and ran it and the money first went out of trust. The second time when he went to UBS, because if when he goes to UBS, he doesn't continue it, you have first, I think, $44 million instead of $97 million, but you also have a different set of plaintiffs. They're not us yet. While he's at UBS, he knows about the Ponzi scheme. He continues the Ponzi scheme, but it's not our money yet. We believe there are, but again, if UBS got a hold of this and stopped it, it still wouldn't be our money. So UBS was culpable, and they entered into a settlement agreement as well. But then he leaves in the winter of 2005 to Capital Reef. All of our money goes in, summer of 2006, to we had some poor plaintiffs who put in a week before it went under. So the $56 million that Judge Gonzalez addressed in her motions for summary judgment all went in while he was at Capital Reef. That background is necessary to show he had a full understanding of the Ponzi scheme he was running.
And the evidence to support the damages you rely on the Keys memo.
We attached 24 different exhibits to the motion for summary judgment and several more to the reply to the summary judgment. And they go through the entire chronology. We don't rely on any. There was such an overlap and such an overwhelming overlap of evidence that goes from point A through the end of it. Keys talks about, both in the memo and in the depo, the covered call strategy. That was the strategy DeMarnay employed while at Capitol Reef. That is the same issue that when DeMarnay was asked specifically about the Keyes memo in his deposition and specifically about Keyes' testimony in his deposition. You were the treasurer of Capitol Reef. You knew this money was transferring. Did you stop it? All these questions he took the Fifth about. And I think there's some procedural background things that I think are important, too. Mr. DeMarnay's answer to the complaint, he takes the Fifth 234 separate times. He takes the Fifth to all of the RICO violations, by the way, which were, he was a named defendant in, some of them specifically mention him, some of them mention all defendants. Now, if we just take a rule-orientated look at this, and we take a look at Rule 8, and if you don't deny the allegation, the complaint that's deemed admitted, well, he, by taking the Fifth and not responding, is deemed to have admitted. He doesn't get an extra benefit by taking the Fifth. He's admitted everything.
Did you argue that to the district court in your MSJ?
We argue that by taking the Fifth, he's admitted everything. I did not mention the answer in the motion, reply, or in the oral argument. But it is part of the record. And part of his focus in this brief has been about the complaint. So if the focus is the complaint, I think we should look at the answer, too. But even looking at the complaint, paragraph 44 of the complaint says DeMarnay left his position at UBS to become the treasurer of Capitol Reef. Paragraph 171 talks about Capitol Reef acquired exchange intermediaries to gain access to additional funds to keep the Ponzi scheme alive. Paragraph 172 says the scheme was doomed to fail. DeMarnay, and it mentions other defendants, all knew that Southwest would eventually collapse. There's no time limits in these allegations. Everything you heard about time limits is self-imposed. Paragraph, when I look through the RICO causes of action, paragraph 330, upon information and belief, DeMarnay also had access to exchange funds entrusted to Southwest. Now, that was when he was at Southwest. And again, there's no time limitation in that allegation. I can go through.
Mr. Cook, again, just to get this straight, after Mr. DeMarnay left both Citi and UBS, and he worked for this other company,
Capitol Reef,
the trust money, we'll call it, the 1031 exchange money, was being utilized to buy call options on the stock market. Is that correct? Is that what the evidence showed?
It was a bad buildup of bad circumstances. The initial money goes to a company they created called Blackstone. Some of it went to a different company they created called Triple I. They go offshore in a number of different investments that didn't go through. Now, the problem is once that happened, now they're trying to save it, so they're pumping more money through for more investments, trying to make up what they've lost, and in the meantime, closing property deals with other people's property. Frankly, this is maybe the one time we can say the IRS showed a little compassion, because from 2004 forward, they could have technically, under 1031, disallowed every exchange, because the whole concept is it's supposed to be your own money held. And it wasn't the minute this transaction happened, but it continued, and the debt got larger and larger and larger as they tried to make up for their out-of-trust commitment.
So that's where the call options came in, trying to do high-risk things to make quick money.
When he called it his cash-covered call strategy, that was a number of different investments that include some higher risk and some lower risk stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all reckless investing, but it was investing money that's supposed to maintain in trust. They were out of trust. And it frankly doesn't matter whether they put it in a AAA stock or the stratosphere. It's supposed to be my money that stays there under the code. And they knew it, and they continued to do it, and the Ponzi scheme got bigger and bigger, and when our money went in, they were out of trust. And certainly, I can go through some different aspects of the complaint and show how they were on notice that this covered, particularly the RICO cause of action, but I would also add that, again, the answer doesn't deny anything. But one of the other things they filed early on was they filed a motion. We sought injunction against them, against DeMarnay and several of the other individuals. He then, in opposing the injunction, attached one of our injunction requests to his motion to point out that we were seeking money against him individually. That particular document he attached, which is part of the record, it's in our respondent's appendix 737, says in March 2005, DeMarnay left UBS to become an officer and director of various entities owned and controlled by McGann. DeMarnay did have and continues to have access to the absconded funds described above, the proceeds or fruits of such absconded funds, or both. He attaches that to demonstrate why he should get certain relief with regard to the injunction, but I say it to you today so you can understand. He knew full well from the beginning. That's before he even filed his answer.
So tell us why the releases don't give him some protection from this, whether it's the dates involved, the money was taken, or the wording of the releases, or what. Why do you think the judge was correct in not applying those releases?
For me, the releases is somewhat of an academic issue more than an issue I need for my complaint, because I don't think there's any reasonable argument you've heard, nor that the district court heard, that the releases would govern the time at Capitol Reef. So with that caveat that we prevail because our money went in when he was at Capitol Reef anyway, when you take a look at the releases...
Except the counsel argues that paragraph 44 is the causation paragraph, and that the causation commences with his activities at Citi and UBS.
Paragraph 44 is not our causation paragraph. There was over 200 different paragraphs of this complaint.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't even gotten to the... At this stage, we're going through who the parties are. We haven't even gotten to the facts that alleged and led to the complaint or the causes of action. That's absolutely not true. When we look at the releases, there's a couple things important to note in the context of when this release happened. As they put in their opposition to motion for summary judgment, at the time the releases happened, there were only two defendants left, Citibank and DeMarnay. And then Citibank settles and DeMarnay is the only one left. It would have been easy to have a dismissal of this case if the intent was to dismiss DeMarnay. It would have been easy to add his signature to this complaint, to the release, if it was designed to release DeMarnay. They didn't do either of those things, and I certainly don't hear any argument from DeMarnay that he was somehow a third-party beneficiary and that he had any reliance on Citibank for that. So if the intent was for him to be released by this, it would have been real easy. You wouldn't have put in paragraph 3A that says, dismissals with prejudice of all claims against Citigroup and its related persons except Peter James, P.J. DeMarnay. If it was your intent to release him, that paragraph's not there. There's no way you can, in constructing the contract, give all due respect and understanding to the words used in there and find that it still applies to him anyway. And the context is also important. Remember, we had a significant settlement in here from Citibank. We had a significant one from UBS. And they both believe that the reason they've got to pay is because of P.J. DeMarnay. They're not going out of their way to do this guy a favor. He just cost them $50 million, or, well, $35 and $25 million approximately.
Counsel, if you concede that 44 doesn't... apply to your parties, where should we be looking?
I'm sorry?
If you're conceding that 44 doesn't apply to your parties, so to speak, as to causation, where should we be looking as to the causation for your later named parties?
What I'm saying is paragraph 44 of the complaint addresses who the parties were. This identifies DeMarnay as an individual at UBS. In other words, I believe what this paragraph does is, among all of the other paragraphs, it's cumulative, of course, but identifies DeMarnay, and we're recognizing at his time as treasurer of Capitol Reef, he's responsible for. The complaint, for instance, the RICO causes of action, which are 61 to, I think, 68, 66, include the causation ones in 359, 360. The RICO defendants' actions have caused and will continue to cause damage to plaintiffs in each of them in excess of $10,000. The RICO defendants named laundered funds, participated in the laundering of funds obtained as a result of a RICO conspiracy through the purchase and sale of medical assets and stock, the diversion of 1031 exchange funds among the RICO defendants, or the payment to RICO defendants for services not rendered or services of no value. Again, no time limitation. RICO defendants includes DeMarnay. And we have that with regard to all of the causes of action. And when we get to the conclusion of the factual ones before we get to each stated cause of action, we have the generic causation paragraph as well. But there's no, if the intent of the release is to get back to Justice Gibbons' question, was to release DeMarnay with only two defendants, it's easy. You put a signature line on, you include it in the stipulation, you don't have language that says everybody except him, because at this time everybody else was done except him. They want you to read language, they want you to create the phrase in this document that says course and scope. It does not say course and scope. If they wanted to say course and scope, it would be there. If he was a third-party beneficiary, where was his reliance? Where was that argument? Where was his signature in this as an intended third-party beneficiary? The words in 3A are words of exclusion, not of inclusion. And again, when you're the only guy left at the table, if that was truly the intent, why wasn't he part of the agreement, and why was 3A included at all at that point? There's no way you can read the agreement as a whole and not understand they weren't looking to help the guy that hurt them and got them into this.
Well, the language, all acts and omissions, seems pretty broad.
Well, now you're referring to the two pages later language, I assume.
I'm referring to paragraph 3A, 3, 5A, or 3A?
Yeah, I think that's 5A. 3A is the
one. 5.
3A says, dismissal with prejudice of all claims against Citigroup and its related persons except Peter James DeMarnay.
Well, it doesn't stop. Whoa, it doesn't stop there. As defined in paragraph 3E5.
Right.
So you can't just stop the interpretation of that clause without considering what might be included in 3E5.
I agree. The reason I'm focusing on 3A is because their argument below and their argument in their brief didn't mention 3A, and I'm saying that needs to be included in the analysis. I agree both have to be included in the analysis. What I'm saying is they didn't include one. In including both, which continues later on and says, DeMarnay was employed by Citigroup and does not extend to acts or omissions DeMarnay committed after his employment with Citigroup terminated. They're reading that to be an entire course in scope. I believe if you read that in context with 3A and also consider the other obvious factors that they were the only two left at the time this was signed, there's no signature spot for DeMarnay, there's no third-party beneficiary argument, the language which is exclusionary in 3A would not have had to have been included at all if that was the intent. The Fifth Amendment issue was addressed somewhat, and I'm happy to address that with the 50 seconds I've got left here real quickly. We don't need to reach the Francis versus Wynn case in this. This is a case where his own admissions negate his ability to refute. We don't need, because again, we've got the myriad of other exhibits and evidence that go through this process. The admissions essentially demonstrate he can't refute any of those things. We don't need to reach the extra step and have you relook at Francis versus Wynn, because it was factually somewhat different because they were looking for a stay as opposed to looking for affirmation. We don't need to get there. Even based on the admissions or the lack of defense to those items, we prevail as to all of those factual allegations as contained in the motion for summary judgment and the complaint. If the court has no further questions, I'll sit down.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Douglas, thank you for that additional 2 minutes. Getting to the releases, counsel misunderstands the paragraph he's relying upon. The paragraph 3A has nothing to do with releases. It's a dismissal paragraph. It defines who is being dismissed. And indeed, P.J. DeMarnay was not being dismissed from the case. We've never argued otherwise. Clearly, all the other city defendants were, but P.J. was not, because the release only reached his conduct during his term of employment, and plaintiffs were free to pursue him on all other conduct. So it's really a red herring, quite frankly. The court has correctly focused on, well, we've got really misconduct going from, call it 2004 through 2007. The release cuts off, the second release, UBS, on February 05. What about PJ's culpability for post-February 5 conduct? That's the issue. Number one, there's no evidence that PJ was employed by Capitol Reef. They don't provide an a paycheck, anything from the company indicating he's employed. No evidence. They assert it. The documents, the 18 or 20 exhibits or so that they focus on, were attached to their motion for summary judgment, the fact pattern of which stopped in July of 2004. That was their case, and it had been from the outset per the master complaint in paragraph 44. They needed to come forward on summary judgment, and they need to say, this is what PJ did. They pointed, you know, he did this or he did that, and this is how it caused damages. You can't look to a memo that's not admissible and saying that he was managing the funds. Who says he didn't make money when he was managing them? They didn't say he stole them.
Did you object to the consideration of the Keys memo by the judge?
Here's exactly how that happened, Your Honor. The short answer is yes. Here's how it came in. They filed their motion for summary judgment in which the fact pattern ceased in July of 2004. And that was consistent with their complaint. We filed our opposition. In their reply, filed on, I believe, the day or the day before the hearing, they then launch into this whole post-UBS allegation, and it was to that, in that document, that reply, that was the first time that they had pointed to the alleged Keys memo. The document, and again, we point out that the deposition transcript of Mr. Keys that was attached to the underlying motion said nothing about any conduct after July 9 of 2004.
So when they tendered the Keys memo in their reply, did you object to the use of it by the judge?
We did. What we did is we went in on Rule 59 and Rule 52, and we sought relief from the court's judgment. I don't see where that's attached in our syllabus.
So you did it after the summary judgment was entered under 59 and 52, is that correct?
We did, and we objected. We said, look, we just said due process, coming in, they're changing their entire context of their argument. They're now talking about post-UBS conduct. They've never mentioned that before.
Did the judge have a hearing upon the motion?
Yes.
Did you object at the hearing saying, wait a minute, judge, this stuff's late, it's in a reply, we didn't get a chance to respond, you know, before she entered her ruling in the case?
I can't remember the exact context of it. I can tell you that we were disappointed. Our whole thing was this, that we objected to the entire concept of the court considering anything that happened after February 5th of 2005. We said that that's a failure of due process, that the court can't consider it, it's outside the scope of their complaint and their motion. So you don't get to, you know, set the whole case up as one period of time and then come in on the reply and backdoor me the day before the hearing on a completely different period of time with new evidence. And we didn't get any traction with that, so we came back in again under Rule 59, Rule 52. Said, look, this is an injustice. The Keys memo is hearsay. It's not admissible. It's in the wrong period of time, due process, all these things. And in the opposition to our appeal, it was not argued that that the Keys memo was not objected to. If it had been, in my reply brief in this thing, I would have brought in all of those pleadings. They never make that argument. Similarly, I hear today for the first time that all about these monies that were actually lost were the ones that came in after 2005 and were 2006. There's nothing below that says anything about when any monies ever came into this, into Southwest.
Well, that's why I asked the question about the interest accrual date and the judgment. It refers to a date in 07, so that indicates to me that the money, if the monies had come in 04 and 05, the interest rate would have been way back when they came in. So I don't know.
Well, plaintiff never made any distinctions, never provided any facts, never did anything to indicate what monies were actually lost, what came in, what came out. We relied on the complaint to the extent that they said this is when all the misconduct happens, when they took control of the company and gave it over to this guy and he took the money.
But the tort wouldn't have been committed, allegedly committed by your client until they actually put the money in. The fact that there were torts before that as to other investors really doesn't matter to these people. The day their money went in, when the money was removed, that would be the conversion, and that would give rise to the causes of action.
And that's one of our points on appeal, is that below, they didn't make that distinction. They didn't say what monies were lost. Were those monies that were put in and taken out, you know, prior to the PJ leaving UBS, or did they go in and come out afterward? There was no, it was just one thing. And according to the complaint, and that's really the only guideline that we have to what money they're talking about, it all happened in at Citi.
So your position is your client had nothing to do with the conversion of these funds because he was gone by then. Is that correct?
Our position is it's twofold. It's what you've said, and it's that even if you look at the Keys memo and you consider it, all it says is that PJ was a money manager at that time. It didn't say he made any decisions with regard to the money. It didn't say he lost any money. It didn't, you know, they're trying to characterize his in-the-money call strategy as being some horrible thing. There's no evidence to that effect. So even if you admitted it, accepted it, relied upon it, that's not fraud, causation, damages, and all those things. That's number one. But number two, our real thrust of the case is that you got to bring evidence. You just can't come in, and because PJ has got a dark cloud over him or people got hurt, you don't say, okay, well, you're liable for everything. You've got to prove your case. You've got to show he was employed at Capitol Reef. What did he do at Capitol Reef? And you've got to let the defendant know what you think he did so he can defend himself. You don't walk in and all of a sudden you get a reply before the date of the hearing and we got a whole different period of time now that we're dealing with. That's not fair to him. He didn't get a fair shot. And they didn't have any evidence.
But Tony, I'm going to cut you off at that point. We've gone way past our 2 minutes, but with that, I thank Mr. Pantone and Mr. Cook for the arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted, and as I indicated, Justice Perigary will review the matters presented this day before a decision is reached. Matter submitted. We stand in recess.